True crime today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015, an environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed for what?
Welcome to today's episode of the program. We're putting this one together for you on December 6th of 2022, coming out in the afternoon with the latest information that we have on today's episode. We're going to be talking about the time window that the authorities are trying to focus on between 9 p.m. November 12th and 1:45 a.m. on November 13th. We'll get into that a little bit. We'll be hearing from an FBI investigator, Bill Daly, on some analysis that he has on this quadruple murder case as officials are now getting into week four of this. We'll dive into the thought process, the profile of who likely should be looked at in this, and do they have anyone that even fits this profile? We'll talk deeper about the stalker information and what Steve Gonsalves has recently said. And we'll talk also a little bit about guilt. Someone who committed a crime like this, are they feeling guilt? Is that something that's going to come into play as the weeks, and we're getting close to a month on this, continue to play out? This, of course, is the University of Idaho podcast. Four killed for what? Thank you guys for joining us. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any updates. We'll try and get you breaking information as it happens and our updates here day by day as this continues to unfold and pressure continues to mount and attention continues to be put onto the police and the investigators to find answers to this absolutely horrific crime. My name is Tony Bruschi. Sean Reed is with us on today's episode as well. Welcome.
Yeah, Tony, you know, the latest information right now, we know a lot about Madison and Kaylee's whereabouts, where they went downtown, then they went to the food truck, then they got a private party ride home. But really, investigators and police right now are trying to zero in on the whereabouts of Zaina and Ethan, and specifically what went on between their time at the frat house on their way home as possibly an area where they can zero in more on to perhaps get a lead.
What I'm wondering here is, why don't we know more about that time window? I would imagine if you're at a frat house and there's a party going on, there'd be a lot of people there that could easily validate, yes, they were here from this time to that time. Granted, it's college kids drinking and having a good time. And, you know, you don't exactly necessarily pay a lot of close attention to time when you're doing that because you're not realizing that the moments you are living are going to be, you know, brutally scrutinized in a quadruple homicide. But I would think maybe we'd hear something by now from people on the scene.
You'd think. I also believe that when you have surveillance involved and you're downtown, there's a lot more people to vet information. I mean, the next day, if not 48 hours after the actual stabbing took place, we had the food truck Twitch video feed. So clearly, when you have surveillance, you see the people on video that are now dead. You're absolutely going to explore all of those opportunities opposed to an on-campus party where, to the moment that we are talking right now, there is no surveillance. Again, you would think and hope, whether it's Snapchats, whether it's Instagram videos, some piece of digital evidence that they can put together a timeline of Zaina and Ethan's whereabouts specifically within the frat house that then got home. But, you know, when you think about it, if there is surveillance and it is a private party that is driving Kaylee and Madison home, you're going to go there and exhaust all leads where you have some hard evidence and video surveillance opposed to hearsay at a frat house party.
I wonder about this. Are they focusing too much on just digital evidence? I mean, we had to solve cases prior to digital evidence being everywhere. Are they just solely focusing on that area and not doing more old school investigative work, maybe because they have no experience doing old school investigative work, and really getting in there and getting into some of these people's minds and digging deeper, not just what's coming up on the log of a Ring doorbell?
That's also a great point. And early on in the investigation, there was some thoughts that some of the students at that frat house would be fearful of coming forward by way of them consuming alcohol under the age of 21. You would like to think that investigators and local law enforcement would assure them and comfort them, we don't care about this or you being 19 or 20 and not being able to, of legal drinking age. If you have information, we need and want to hear that now.
And that's what I wonder, if there is some of that sitting out there. Have they officially said that, you know, please come forward, we're not going to care about anything? Because that needs to be a clear message, I think, to the students of, look, you're smoking pot, you're drinking, we don't care. You're getting a free pass on this one. Any information you have, we want to know.
That's a valid point. Of course, they hammer the tip line as far as the number and what it's referred to as King Homicides on the City of Moscow Police Department's website. They're good at providing updates, but that's definitely something that perhaps law enforcement can do and be more assertive and aggressive
or clear
on all social media.
Or clear,
by the way.
their biggest problem is clarity more than anything else, where they constantly contradict themselves, or they kind of slightly suggest something and then they pull back on it. So I would assume, I mean, and even if, you know, you are risking getting something, obviously if you have information that leads to who did this, I would think you would be coming forward. And again, maybe there just isn't a whole lot of information at what happened at that party. If they were there the whole time, they don't know for sure if they were there the whole time. But if they were, it might have just been sitting around drinking. I mean, that may be the answer to it. And police are sitting here not having a whole lot of information yet, hoping maybe there's something in that window. And that may point to absolutely nothing whatsoever. We don't know yet. Former FBI investigator Bill Daley provided an analysis of the Idaho quadruple murder case as officials now go into week 4 without identifying any of the suspects. He said this to Fox News.
This is a more complicated case than all of a sudden have, I call this aha moment, where you have an immediate suspect or suspects that are kind of in near proximity to this case. You kind of round them up and it kind of moves forward and towards prosecution. This one's a bit more complicated. We've talked about this before with regard to the crime scene. The evidence being collected needs to be processed. I do say that the fact that police have not been communicating is good for a couple of reasons. Mm. Not good for the family, I know, not good for the community. But from a investigative standpoint, it A, doesn't provide information to the killer or killers, or it doesn't provide information to people who are potentially be interviewed, where they could be polluted by things that they say. And thirdly, it doesn't pollute the prosecution, which is very key in this, is they need to keep their eyes on the long game here. And that is, when they catch the person, and I believe they will, hopefully sooner than later, they need to look for a prosecution and make sure that nothing's been tainted or could be used in to reverse a prosecution.
Which is a very good point. There has been many cases where things get tainted in the actual development of the case, in the prosecution of the case, in the investigation of the case, that then attorneys are able to go back and say, See, this wasn't handled right. And if you don't know that for sure, then even all this other evidence over here points to it. But this part, very questionable. So that does make some sense. One would hope that that's what is going on. Even the other night, Kaylee's dad said, I hope I'm wrong on this, you guys. I hope there's a moment where you come out and say, we got him. We couldn't say anything because of this. And I will be the first to say, I am wrong. You guys were doing your job. And my assumption of you guys was wrong. I think we all hope that. There hasn't been a lot of confidence being built on the part of the police, just with the contradictory statements over the past couple of weeks. So they need to kind of get a little bit in recovery mode and come back from that and not assume like they've just been flawless in what they've been saying to the families and to the general public, because there is a need for this information to an extent, especially when you don't have a man in custody. You have a small town and 4 people just got murdered. There's going to be the risk, and other profilers will tell you, that this person could strike again. So to be aware, which is the opposite of what they said at the beginning, is rather key. And most of us would have said, yeah, be aware. Why do we have to go back to the police and say, maybe you should tell people to be aware? It just doesn't do a lot for confidence in any of this.
At this point, again, with them focusing in finding more details with Zaina and Ethan. You can only hope that something is the aha moment, yeah, as the former FBI agent said. But quite honestly, my gut and my theory, they're never going to find a suspect. And it's not because their investigation, it's because the suspect is no longer living.
Oh, so you're going down the road of, now obviously completely speculation here. And we want to say that, I said that in the Gabby Petito case, I said right away, like, Brian, he's dead, but that's why you're not going to find him. And then they ended up finding him dead. I wonder here, I don't know that this person is dead. I will talk about grief and guilt and all that, a little bit later. Let's kind of go back onto the track of more the timeline, what they're looking at, some of the confusion that exists. One of the things that was brought up in a couple different ways and is still not completely off the table. I read a lot of the message boards and the Reddits and all that, and I listen to a lot of people's theories and such. And very quickly, people dismiss the idea of the stalker thing. It's been dismissed. It has not been dismissed. The police investigated one incident that they were able to kind of narrow in on or hone in on a little bit, and they were able to dismiss that. But they're not saying that that was the end-all, be-all of stalkers. Here's what Brian Enten was able to get the other day in a conversation when he was talking with Steve Gonsalves about the idea or the accusations that did Kaylee have a stalker?
I said this, she's a pretty girl, her friends are really pretty, so them attracting attention was pretty common wherever they went. So I think she attracted attention. Whether that's a dedicated person following her around, maybe not. I do believe that the officers looked in it, and I believe what they said, that there was no evidence there.
Yeah, what they said, this is a statement that was made. Using tips and leads, investigators have identified an incident involving Kaylee at a local business, which may have been the stalker reference she made to friends and family. May have been. In mid-October, two males were seen inside a local business. They parted ways, and one male appeared to follow Kaylee inside the business. And as she exited to walk towards her car, the male turned away, and it did not appear he made any contact with her. Detectives contacted both males and learned the two were attempting to meet women at the business. This was corroborated through additional investigations based on available information. Detectives believe that this was an isolated incident and not an ongoing pattern of stalking. No evidence suggests the two males were involved in the murders. So I trust that there. They looked into this one thing that they were able to, kind of triangulate in on. But I'm going to guess, and I think any woman will tell you, that it's throughout their years of college and such, there's usually not just one type of creepy stalker person that they will run into. Some are just kind of out there, and some a little more aggressive. And that's what I'm wondering, because investigators continue to look into information about Kaylee having a stalker. They didn't just stop there and say, okay, this is it. Nobody else would have shown any interest in her or stalked her. We got this one and we're done, guys. They're saying information about a potential stalker or unusual occurrences should go through the tip line. And that's something that they really should be looking at. And I'm glad that they are.
Absolutely. And to your point of, it's not just a one incident or occurrence. And this is two of us, males not having to deal with a night out of the town or just going to Target as a attractive female, of what they have to deal with on a daily basis of how gentlemen react to them. But what's truly interesting is, if there is not a killing that takes place in this, is this stalker a stalker, or is this just a creepy guy being overly aggressive wrong of how to talk to or attempt to talk to an attractive woman?
Well, and it sounds like that might have been what happened at the bar that they cleared up from several weeks ago. But what I do wonder about are other characters that have shown up in this case, other characters that have been dismissed sometimes, other characters that have even been spoken about by Kaylee's father with the New York Post. And we're talking about the hoodie guy, and I'm not going to say a name or anything of that nature. People have speculated as to his identity. It's never been confirmed, so we really don't truly know officially who the hoodie guy is in the video at the food truck. The police also say this statement, and I think it's very quick to be dismissed as, well, that sums up this. He's not a person of interest. They say the male in the video. If you look at the food truck videos, there's several male in the video. Several men. So which one are we talking about? I mean, can we be a little more specific about who's ruled out? I believe they've been somewhat specific on the guy who runs the truck cleared. But there is that hooded figure that's out there. And we're not going to say any names or anything of that nature. I know some are floating around online. But, I mean, I don't know why it doesn't beg the question to ask that and maybe get some answers. It's been...
And police?
Go ahead.
Police have also said, we recognize the frustration this causes and that speculation proliferates in the absence of facts. However, we firmly believe speculation and unvetted information is a disservice to the victims, their families, and our community. And what's interesting, you say, well, can't the question be asked to give some solid information, who has been vetted, who has been cleared, who has not? But then that falls into the prior speak when you bring in attorneys and what can be used if and when a trial occurs. Don't you on purpose have to be purposely vague so that you don't put yourself in a corner where a suspect who is ultimately caught can then use it against you and get off?
But why are we saying absolute, saying that the man in the video has been cleared? That doesn't make any sense. There's many men in that video.
Again, if they are too specific.
Why make any, don't make a statement then, period. If you're going to make it's just a statement that doesn't even make sense. It's a nonsensical statement. The man in the video has been, which one? And if you're going to say it, be specific, because you have intent. You're saying a man, the man has been cleared. Then say who? Just be a little more clear on that, because it's been notoriously vague with all of their releases. I think we're really honestly kind of dealing a little bit with we said too much or we said too little, and they're just kind of walking this fine line of, can we say what? And it's little's leaking here, little's leaking there, little's being pulled back here. Obviously, this has got to be just freaking insane for those families, as they just want some answers. When asked if they're happy with the investigation, Brian Enten asked that on News Nation. Kaylee's family had this to say, and this is Kaylee's sister speaking.
I think it's hard to say this way or that. They're obviously holding it very tight to chest, which could either be a really, really great sign or a really, really bad sign. And I think depending on not even the day, the hour, especially my dad and I, we go back and forth between they got this and kind of falling apart a little bit and, you know, really looking at specific events that have been strange or maybe should have been looked into more in our eyes.
I think a lot of it looks strange to everybody. And a lot of things that should have been looked. I completely agree. I just wonder when we're going to start getting some of that. Let's talk about the profile of a killer and what we may be dealing with here, other than speculation of someone's wearing a hoodie or not, or if they were just hanging out in the wrong place at the wrong time. Jim Clementine is a retired FBI supervisory special agent and criminal behavior analyst. He spoke with Fox News Digital, and he believes that the suspect is likely a young man who's not carried out such violent crimes before. Said he's sloppy. Went on to say to Fox News Digital that this is probably more of a compulsive kind of person that would put him at a younger age, maybe in an age group or just above the victims. I don't think he's particularly sophisticated, criminally sophisticated, or forensically sophisticated, he added. Kelly's decision to commit such a brazen crime was indicative of his relationship with one or more of the victims, Clementine hypothesized. Going into an occupied dwelling with six people in different rooms in the middle of the night is an extremely high-risk crime, unless he knows one or more of the people, the former New York City prosecutor said. So that is my first thought on this. The offender did not just randomly choose this location, that he targeted one or more of the people in there. That could be because he has a relationship or past relationship with one or more of them, or it could be that he's been stalking one or more of them. A profile that really does fit into a lot of what I've been saying earlier on in this when I believe this guy is an incel, maybe not actively on communities online, but I think that personality type, there's an anger towards women here. There's an anger that he was slighted by one of the women or more of the women in the house, with every right to be slighted, because he was probably being creepy one or more times around them, and he was rejected and probably not even thought twice about by whoever rejected him. Because again, these are attractive girls. They're on a college campus. They get hit on God knows how many times a day. But some
this
people
is definitely something that you look at the question of, was this just a random attack, or did this person have details, have a plan in place? In addition to that question is how much rage and how much of one's childhood is brought into this. He could have recently done something creepy, been rejected, and then carried out this terrible, terrible stabbings. But perhaps earlier in life, he was bullied. Earlier in life, there were other contributing factors that gave enough rage to carry out something like this. So it's not just a month ago at a party, he was flirting with one of the victims. They said no. And then a month later, you know what? I'm going to kill all of you.
I think
this is on top of years and years of somebody who perhaps needed some help, perhaps needed to channel the ideas and the anger and the rage and the sadness and the depression prior to taking it out on four innocent victims.
There's a lot of young men like this that are out there. There are a ton that have this rage, this feeling of women don't like me, I can't attract them, it's not my choice to be celibate, but I am, because damn them. And they don't realize all the things they're doing to turn women off. I mean, I've worked with some in the past, and I've seen their rage turn from just a very easygoing individual to suddenly they're talking about some woman that slighted them. And it's like, holy shit, like 0 to 100 in a couple seconds, and completely off base in the rage and the thinking. And then you look a little deeper and you get to know them a little bit more, and you go, okay, look at the mom situation, look at this or that. I mean, so yes, you go back to anybody, they're going to have whatever, you know, kind of built the person who they are. You'll have signs there that made them who they are today. A big question I think a lot of people have, and it's something that you brought up off the air, is guilt. Does someone like this, who was capable of committing these crimes, do they feel guilty? Do they feel bad? I think in the case, we had talked a little bit earlier of Brian Landry and Gabby Petito, he killed himself. He was feeling horribly guilty. Something happened there that snapped, but he didn't seem to fit the profile of, you know, an incel or have a lot of hate towards women. He just seemed like someone who probably had some anger issues that really went off the rails. This, I don't think we're dealing with a similar type individual, but tell me about that. Tell me your thoughts on guilt and what someone like this may be feeling.
So we're a week away from this being a month old, from when the events occurred in the early morning hours of November 13th, with no leads, no persons of interest, no suspects. And my thought is, and my theory is, we would have already found out who this killer was. To be so bold and so brazen to carry out such gruesome acts, you want to be found. You almost look at this as a trophy of sorts, a participation ribbon. You almost want to become a 15 minutes of fame, a celebrity. You're on every newspaper across the country. You're on every news outlet website, because you are so screwed in the mind and the head that you look at this as an accomplishment. That's on one side.
Mm-hmm.
Which clearly, as we're 3 weeks into this, that has not occurred, which is what my theory truly goes to.
It's kind of like
this individual is no longer living, because the guilt. Maybe they had the pompous arrogance and rage to actually commit the crime, but then a day or two or a week, or at this point, 3 weeks goes by where they can't take it. There's different types of guilt. There's reactive guilt, just doing some digging on how the mind truly works. Reactive guilt, where we commit an act, and then after the fact, we realize, holy shit, we probably shouldn't have done that. Anticipatory guilt is when we know that we're going to do something that is wrong, we ultimately do it. But we already knew before we did something that it was wrong, and that we probably shouldn't have done it in the first place. And then finally, there's existential guilt occurs when a person struggles with who they are, what they are, and their place in the world, which we briefly touched on could be a little bit of their upbringing, their childhood. You toss in some rage, not feeling good enough. Well, I'm going to absolutely show you how good I am. They commit the crime.
Yeah.
But again, it all comes down to, in my opinion, that it occurred, and for whatever reason, they chose to carry out this attack, but the guilt got too much that they couldn't take it anymore, and ultimately took their own life.
And do you think this is someone that they would have known? Because there hasn't really been any, I think we would have heard by now of someone, if they were in this circle of just being on the campus, like anyone who was on the campus that would have been known in any way, shape or form as a student, as a friend, as somebody, and they died right now. We'd be honing in on that really quick just to see, but we've heard nothing of the sort.
You would think also you have to understand or not comprehend, but realize that you have X amount of students who never return from Thanksgiving break. And also, it's curious, okay, we're still in semester, we're still in school, but how many detectives are looking at, okay, what students were doing coursework up until X date, and now they have not attended any online classes, been absent.
So, which could mean anything, which could mean they're stressed, which could mean they're trying to deal with this, and it doesn't mean that they're guilty of anything, and that's really hard to narrow down and go, you know, let's look at this. I disagree on the person even feeling guilt. I think this is someone with an antisocial personality disorder of some type. And what type that is, I think we really won't know until they find who it is. But an antisocial personality disorder, it's a lot like what I've been talking about, an incel. We're talking about a persistent pattern of behavior that demonstrates a disregard for the needs and rights of other people. In three or more of these ways, this is how the DSM describes an antisocial personality. And if I were someone that was there, if I was someone that was in these fraternities, if I was someone that was friends, if I was someone that had any connection to this circle inside, and I know many of you are probably listening, take a little look around and listen to this and see if this describes anyone to you. And I don't know who that would be, but I think this is the type of profile we would be looking for. Just my opinion. Repeated behaviors that violate the law and are grounds for arrest. Number two, pathological lying of any type of deceitfulness, low or no impulse control, and inability to plan ahead. Physical aggressiveness in the form of assault or fist fights. Disinterest in other people's safety or their own. Irresponsible behaviors that lead to job loss or financial trouble. Lack of remorse or guilt for hurting others in one way. Things of that nature. Being at least 18 years of age. Concrete evidence of challenging behavior before the age of 15. Those sort of things are things we need to be looking for. Moderate or significant impairment in at least two of these areas. Identity, self-direction or self-discretion, empathy, intimacy. Having six or more of these pathological personality traits. Being someone who is manipulative, callous, deceitful, hostile, risk-taking, impulsivity, irresponsibility. We're, in my opinion, going to find somebody who's probably a sociopath, psychopath, borderline, something along these lines, where they are not feeling guilt. They are feeling that they did the right thing and these people got what they deserved. That's what my guess is once, and hopefully they do find out who did this. I think it'll drive everyone insane because there'll be someone behind bars that's not showing any remorse, any empathy, any guilt. They're very plain-faced, and in their mind, what they did is right. And there's no way of really changing that in folks like that unless they somehow come around to that conclusion. And that's the scariest thing about these people. And they don't necessarily go and kill themselves either. They just kind of go off. And there's so many cases we're seeing now where DNA evidence is finally catching people who committed horrible crimes many, many years ago, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And now suddenly through genealogical DNA evidence, oh my God, it's someone's uncle. It's someone's father. It's someone. And the rest of their life, they lived it pretty normal, but they were able to pull off such horrible, horrible acts and pretend to be someone else. People like that, they're always pretending to be another person. At the inner core, they're a shell, but they're always putting some sort of act on to be this or that and trying to take cues from the rest of society as to how to perform, if you will, because life to them is almost a performance. And how what is acceptable, what's not acceptable. But these people have a very low tolerance for any sort of adversity, for being rejected, anything that's going to make them feel down or question that very narrow, dark sense of self that they have. And this is where you see people like that snap and do horrible things. That's the profile I'm going with on this. Again, just where I'm guessing, there's nothing based on anything yet. But if you were to throw a pie together and go, who's likely the type of individual who would do this? I'd say that probably has the biggest piece of the pie.
Well, then I take solace in those that are being painted incorrectly because they can feel. If you can feel, yeah. If you have empathy, and you are related in the friend circle, mm-hmm. An acquaintance of these victims, then a large apology is sent your way of being wrongly proven guilty or assumed in this.
And there's so many names, and that's why we're not going to throw out names.
Somebody that fits that profile, they could care less what people are saying about them because mm-hmm. they don't particularly know how to care, or they choose not to. But yep. In my opinion, anybody with any type of feeling, any emotion that carried out this act, it would be far too much to try to digest and move on with day-to-day life. That, again, my theory, if you are going to carry this attack out, one person, four victims, stabbing in the middle of the night, you can't take it. If you have any type of feeling and emotion.
If you're not an antisocial personality disorder individual, yes, I 100% agree. However, I think it almost takes someone with that to pull off something like this. Unfortunately, that's what we have for you today. There's not a ton of new developments, but we're, of course, watching this around the clock and going to bring you any sort of breaking news as it happens here on the podcast channel. And, of course, updates as we can put them together for you and these discussions. If you like this program, please be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. We greatly appreciate that. It helps to let other folks know that this exists and continues to put pressure onto the case. And hopefully that attention eventually leads to some sort of resolution. We'll keep you up to date right here. This is a production of True Crime Today, the True Crime Today podcast. You can also download that for more on this story and many other true crime stories. Just search True Crime Today wherever you download podcasts. Until next time, for Sean, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening to the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed for what?